ridiculous thing about Donald Trump's xenophobic, demagogic assault on Central American amnesty seekers is that his frantic demand to build a $5 billion border wall is not his most ridiculous ploy. Even more ridiculous is his panicky political assertion that the caravans coming north through Mexico are gangs of rapists, murderers, and terrorists out to slaughter and conquer us. Never mind that the migrants he demonizes are overwhelmingly women, children, and peaceful families who are fleeing the terrifying gangs, extortionists, and corrupt officials who've turned their lives in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras into hell. But rather than greet these refugees with a policy of common compassion and long-term solutions, Trump and his fellow Republican screechers have militarized the border to separate them from their children, incarcerate them, and turn them into political pawns for Trump's re-election campaign. But wait, it gets more ridiculous. Crying that the three countries should bar these desperate families from fleeing the horrors of home, Trump has peevishly and stupidly cut off U.S. aid intended to battle the gang violence driving them northward. Okay, Trump has no empathy or subtlety, but how smart do you have to be to see that if you have no strategy to help mitigate the nightmarish conditions of your neighbors, you'll have to cope with the fallout on your own doorstep? This is Jim Hightower saying, most ridiculous of all, though, is that we have a president with a moral compass that points only to policies that serve his ego and political needs. Trump doesn't really want any border solution at all, not even a wall. He wants a crisis, a bugaboo to demagogue for his own political advancement, no matter how many families suffer. He's a pathetic weakling of a president, ridiculously masquerading as a strong man.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Thanks for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Teresa Wilkie. On today's program, Eco Radio KC will air from our recording at the Teaching Toward a Sustainable Future, a professional development workshop focused on helping K-12 educators to incorporate local and global knowledge about the environment across the disciplines and to find ways to empower students to be leaders we need to understand the uncertainties and respond to the underlying issues related to shifts in our natural surroundings. Lots of great info. Stay tuned. But first, the environmental news for the week of July 22nd. Democracy Now! Reports, the Environmental Protection Agency announced last week it will not ban the widely used pesticide chlorpyrifos, even though its own research shows it can cause brain damage in children. This is the second major pesticide action EPA has taken this month. EPA said last week it would expand use of the insecticide sulfoxaflor on a variety of crops that it had been previously prohibited due to research showing the chemical is harmful to pollinators such as bees. Staff at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission recommend reduction in government regulations on nuclear power plants. This would allow the nuclear industry to carry out more self-inspections and would slash the size and scope of radiation protection and emergency preparedness inspections at nuclear plants. In South Asia, ongoing heavy rain and flooding have killed at least 100 people and affected more than a million people. In Ecuador, members of an indigenous tribe celebrated as a court upheld a ruling barring the government from selling land in the Amazon to oil companies. The Huayrani argued that they had not been consulted over the government's plan to auction off their ancestral lands. NPR reports, a pathogen that's deadly to some native trees has been found in 10 Illinois counties, including St. Clair and Monroe. The pathogen causes sudden oak death on some ornamental plants. This is a brown spot on the leaves and branch tips of rhododendron, azalea, and lilac, and it's deadly for oaks and certain other tree species. Investigators first discovered the pathogen on rhododendrons at a Walmart in Indiana. The selected plants came from nurseries in the Northwest and were distributed from Park Hill plants in Oklahoma. 18 states, including Illinois and Missouri, received infected plants. Officials have not found the plant disease in any oak trees yet. Sustainability Action Newsletter reports, Cheerios breakfast cereal and several oat-based granolas and snack bars contain dangerous levels of glyphosate. The Environmental Working Group has done extensive research on glyphosate in foods that would affect human health during early childhood formative years. Finally, National Geographic reports, wastewater from oil and gas production injected deep into wells could cause earthquakes strong enough to be felt on the surface for years to come, according to new research. The U.S. Geological Survey says wastewater disposal from oil and gas production is the number one cause of human-induced earthquakes in the central and U.S. They developed a model based on wastewater flows in two fracking-heavy states, Kansas and Oklahoma. They found the wastewater posed a quake risk for decades. In the wake of fossil fuel exploration, the numbers of earthquakes have rocketed from about 20 a year in 2008 to more than 400 annually. They found earthquakes are also getting stronger. Now, our show.
So, as Teresa told you, we are today featuring some speakers and interviews from Teaching Toward a Sustainable Future, which was a workshop that took place recently at KU. And just as some background, we know that the environment we're passing on down to children is becoming less hospitable every day. And while there's a lot of positive actions that we can take individually, one of the most important things we can do is to teach young people how to lead in the future and give them some great educational opportunities to head towards having a healthier planet. So today we're going to hear from farmers and scholars and teachers from this event, and hopefully you'll get some great ideas for things that you can do and things that you can encourage teachers to do, or if you're a teacher, you can do it yourself, or just spread down to the kids that you interact with on a daily basis. So right now we're going to hear from Pantaleon Flores III. And he'll tell you more about what he does and the great work that he's done with kids here and across the country.
My name is Pantaleon. I operate a 3/4-acre farm in North Lawrence called Masewa Kwali Farms. Masewa Kwali means the people, so it's the people's farms, because I view myself more as a food security worker than a farmer. And one of the themes kind of throughout my discussion will be the importance of language and how we use our language and how that matters, which is, I've been really happy to hear a lot of different conversation already kind of around that topic. So when you're introducing yourself and you say, oh yeah, I'm a farmer, I don't feel like that quite does it enough justice. Just like when you all introduce yourself and you say you're a teacher, that's not all you are, and you all know that. I mean, you're a mentor, you're the person, you know, the student who is not making it around the school can run to. You're the person cleaning up after everything. You're doing all these, like, you know, committees and all the side work and taking your work home with you and carrying it through the summer and doing all. You're so much more than teachers, right? You're so much more than just educators. So when I say I'm a food security worker, for me, as someone who has been and is still somewhat food insecure, I like to look at reshaping systems, so rethinking and reshaping systems. So I see my role with the farm specifically primarily to be feeding people. So I have a food donation program where I have an eighth of an acre of land set aside that is just completely donated foods. When I finish farmer's market and I have food left over, that gets immediately donated, because I believe in getting the food where it needs to go first, and then potentially in trying to fundraise money after the fact. So very food first, fund second type of approach. And I know we kind of listed off the things that I'll be talking about. I'll be kind of mixing in all those themes throughout it. So jumping from that idea back to my work in Oakland, I was out in Oakland, California, working at Peralta Elementary in North Oakland. I was the edible garden manager. So this school in Oakland, which gave me so much, like, inspiration and hope for, like, what we could bring back here to Kansas, is, like, I was a garden manager, so we had an edible garden on site, and I was growing food for our culinary teacher at an elementary school. Like, what kind of dream world is the Bay Area? And in doing that, I kind of found myself with my schedule being the co-director of the food security project and then also doing an additional 10 or 15 hours at the school there around lunchtime. So I would be the one that would stand there helping the custodian out, telling them, nope, that doesn't go in that one. Nope, that one doesn't go in that one. And then also eventually realizing how much food waste there was. This is maybe one of the resources for kind of getting into, like, feeding students. Is something that I tried to do something about but didn't quite accomplish in my time in Oakland was I eventually put a fourth bucket out, and I said, if you have untouched fruit that, you know, it's like apples, whole oranges, bags of carrots that are unopened, you know, put them in this five-gallon bucket. I was finding out that I would fill the five-gallon bucket in one lunch period of three lunch periods. And that was the only time I could be there because of my work schedule. So I had all these whole foods that was like 5 gallon buckets a day. And what I wanted to do with that was to basically grab one of the library carts, throw all that food up there so that when parents came to pick up their kids, they could also come and pick up food, right? Because a lot of the kids there, you know, they'd come in without having eaten breakfast. Definitely a population that, you know, dinner would be pretty small. And so I'd like to encourage everyone here to, if you want to take on that role, of course, because like I said, you all have so many roles as teachers, is to maybe create some sort of food pantry or some kind of food recovery program. And it can be something, like I said, as small as what I was trying to do with the little amount of time I had at that school, which is to find a way to capture Whole Foods and to find a way to get it to parents or even have students take it home. So that's kind of my background with the school in Oakland. Kind of returning to the farm, we were talking about our carbon footprint. So I'm kind of interested to know what mine is now on the farm. I'm not sure if that website kind of works with that. But I don't till, so there's no tillage on my farm. I don't use any fossil fuel machinery, so it is all hand labor. Every aspect of the farm. The only thing is that I drive my car back and forth. That's the only fuel that I use on my farm. So I'm wondering if I would have like a 1 or a 2. Like, I wonder how low I'd be, because I'm actually sequestering carbon by not tilling. I don't know, maybe it would even go negative. It depends on how big the scale. So yeah, no till, no fossil fuel. And it's a lot of work. It's definitely worth it. In addition to that, I also do some research. I just got a grant from the USDA's SARE department, which is Sustainable Agricultural Research and Education. So I got a $9,000 grant to bring on two undergraduate researchers who I'm able to pay very well. I get to pay them $18 an hour to help me with this work. I'm doing a comparative yield analysis between how we grow corn today with no-till methods and how my ancestors, my Mexica, my Chichimec ancestors, grew corn from this codex from the 1500s. I like to look back and find these old texts. So the one that I'm specifically talking about is from the 1500s. It outlines all of the growing methods for corn specifically, as it was one of the main staple crops, and still is in a lot of regions of Mexico today. So I would encourage people to also look back when they're doing kind of their research studies or, you know, studies about, student ancestry, to kind of go back in time really, really far. I mean, this is like 500 years back in time. And so far, the ancestral plantings are actually faring a lot better, especially given the amount of rain that we've had this year. Had some crop failure. I know a lot of farmers have. I know a lot of farmers have actually not even been able to plant because they can't get their tractors in the field. I don't have a tractor. Like, this is the tractor. There's definitely a lot of new ways that we can approach the way that we grow food. Returning back kind of to food security, I know I want to talk a lot about that. I'm very passionate about that. Like I said, I was food insecure during graduate school here at KU. I know there's a very big section of the student population here that is also food insecure. You know, skipping meals because it's like, do I want to pay my rent or do I want to eat? I'm like, well, all right. And going kind of also back to language, we talk about food insecurity, and I think that's a really important term. But I think it's also more of like an alleviation to the problem term as opposed to like an eradication of the problem. I believe that food insecurity should be used to lead towards food sovereignty, which is a much higher, much more kind of powerful and impactful way to feed people. I know that we also speak about food deserts. Food deserts, to me, is something that I learned from folks out in California is kind of a little bit dated, actually. A lot of people are just now kind of starting to talk about food deserts. But what we should really be talking about is food apartheid. Because the deserts, I mean, a desert is a very natural occurring thing, right? People not having food is not very natural. There are systems in place, institutions in place that cause that. And that can be a very wide range of reasons. For that, it can be racism, right? Our historical connection to segregation, which we can still see is existent in our cities today. I'm from Topeka, so I can see it literally with the infrastructural types of things. Like Oakland and Topeka, the neighborhood, separated literally by a bridge and a railroad track. And so a lot of these issues that we're seeing are caused by people and by systems that are linked to historical and institutional racism. And so I think when we talk about food security and food justice, we really have to be honest with ourselves first so that we can be then also honest with our students and even, I guess, as we also mentioned, the parents that are coming in and saying, you know, this isn't from CNN, this isn't from Fox News, this is from history class, this is from geography, this is from, you know, this is from our subject matter. It doesn't have to come filtered through some kind of, like, news source or something like that. The other part that I'm really, really passionate about and wanted to speak on is, you know, when I did my master's in education here at KU, we didn't put a lot of focus on multicultural education. I really loved that aspect of my time here as a graduate student, but it didn't feel quite complete for some reason. And I didn't know at the time why, and it took me a little while to research and move to California and find a library that had resources that were from my ancestors here. It's kind of sparse. I've put in some applications to get some books in that are a little more culturally relevant to me, and they've bought them and things like that. But I kind of came to this conclusion that, like, we've gone so global with the way that we and the way that our textbooks are pushing us to teach in our classrooms, that we've, like, the local and the indigenous, especially the indigenous, has kind of been, like, muted, essentially. And so I think it's interesting. I think it would be a great idea, and I tried to do this in Oakland as well when I was working in the elementary school, is to also emphasize indigenous practices. And not just the practices, but also the people who are still very much alive and doing those things. And so I think it's great. While I think it's great to go global and talk about, you know, different countries and different places and things, we should recognize the land that we're standing on, right? This country was founded off of slavery and genocide. That's history. That's not CNN. we're standing currently on stolen land. This is Osage. This is Kaw. This is Kansas land. I recognize that myself as a farmer, I'm also benefiting from stolen land. And I think we need to make people, and especially our young folks, you know, really aware of that fact that, you know, there are still people here who have been disenfranchised. There is a lot of knowledge here that is way more ancient than any settler colonists. The books I'm drawing from are 500, 600 years old. And had maybe we listened to those practices, we might not be in the situation that we're in. One example is not tilling, right? A lot of the practices, pretty much all of the practices I found of indigenous cultures are more permaculture style, or, you know, not tilling. And I believe I read that if we all stopped tilling today, it would basically offset all of the carbon emissions on Earth. Because there are two big carbon sinks. The biggest one is the ocean, so we sink lots and lots of carbon into the ocean, and the second one is soil. Because soil is alive. It is a living beast. Microorganisms, worms, all kinds of bugs, bacterial life, fungal networks, which are super important to healthy soil. I think if we really kind of look at these practices and look backwards It's really, really important, even maybe more so now than it is trying to look forwards and reinvent the wheel, right? Because these wheels of agriculture are 20,000 years old, right? I mean, I know the act, like, the Neolithic Revolution didn't happen everywhere. It happened pretty much everywhere except in Europe. But that's some ancient roots right there. That's some seriously deep, rooted agriculture that is just astounding to think about and to maybe even try and return to. And so as much as I love storytelling for, like, future stories, which are really important, I like hearing the ancient. And so, yeah, I would strongly encourage everyone to bring that multicultural form of education back full circle to really, you know, bringing it back to, like, well, where do we stand in space and time? And how can we move forward by taking lessons that we've already learned as a species to help curb everything that's happening around us right now? Going into these kind of topics is something that you can do, I think, through agriculture specifically, right? So you don't necessarily have to stand there and say, your carbon footprint is so big, you're choking the earth, and da 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 da. You can go in and say, we're going to grow food because there are hungry people, 40 million in this country, 3 million of which are children. That's a little bit of the scary part, but we're going to grow food to help locally support people and people in our community. And at the same time, we're also going to be pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, this big scary thing, and putting it back in the soil where we can sink it down and bring these levels down. So it's kind of, I always hear these kinds of things as like, danger, danger, warning. And it's never followed up with what can we do, right? So I feel like if we lead with, this is what we can do because of this happening, we can kind of shift that language, we can shift that paradigm of like, everyone freak out, we're all dying, to everyone pick up a shovel and do this so that we can continue living.
Best-selling author Parker Palmer has a question for those of us who feel we have a responsibility to repair this broken world.
If you have a good heart, if you want the best for everyone, do you also have the guts to keep working at it when you're not going to get results in your lifetime?
That's next time on Inspired.
Tuesday at noon, right after Link's Mix.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When Homer Walden and Drew Peters started their Pennsylvania farm, the husband and wife team was on a tight budget.
We spent all our money on purchasing our farm.
But Walden loves to tinker.
That's my specialty. You know, I'm constantly looking at what we do day in and day out and trying to keep the costs down.
So he developed inexpensive ways to do some of his farm chores. For example, he built portable pig pens that he can pull over a new patch of land every day. The pigs eat weeds and churn up the ground underneath.
Pig tiller is what I call it. I also call it pulled pork.
After the pigs, Walden puts chickens on the land. They eat bugs and enrich the soil with their waste. So when it's time to clear a patch of land for planting, Walden does not need a tractor or chemical fertilizers. His methods are cheap and reduce carbon pollution. In 2012,
we were given the governor's award for environmental excellence by not using a drop of fossil fuels.
Walden is now teaching others about his low-tech, low-carbon farming methods.
I don't think we can help anybody just by considering our own benefits from these ideas, and it's my quest to share what I've learned.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
15th Annual Crossroads Music Fest is coming September 7th, and tickets are on sale right now. This year's headliners are Madison Ward and the Mama Bear.
Last night I slept in a big yellow taxi.
And Split Lip Rayfield.
Keep you happiness or misery. Don't draw from the deck of misfits.
Joined by over 20 other bands on 6 stages, including The Freedom Affair, Shy Boys, Ensemble America, My Brothers and Sisters, Violet and the Undercurrents, and many more. Support for Crossroads Music Fest Saturday, September 7th comes from the Neighborhood Tourist Development Fund. Over 20 bands and 6 venues on September 7th. Tickets are on sale right now for the KKFI Crossroads Music Fest at cmfkc.com.
And we are rolling back into some more speakers from the Teaching Toward a Sustainable Future. These speakers are actually just short interviews that I conducted with teachers and a student who will be telling us about their responses to some questions. You'll hear the questions in the first interview, and then you'll just hear the responses in each of the others. And then we're going to move on to a great talk from Aaron Musi, who is an education program specialist with the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies at KU. So right now, let's hear from Carol and her thoughts on sustainability and education.
My name's Carol Ruman, and I teach sixth graders at Southwest Middle School in Lawrence, Kansas.
And how do you explain sustainability to your students?
I think it's more presenting it like caring for the environment, like we care for other things, and therefore to ensure that in the long run there's something for everyone.
And what's a positive educational initiative that you've been a part of that represents sustainability to you?
That's hard. I don't know. I mean, like, we do composting at our school, which is like the sixth grade initiative. So promoting that. And whenever I do things, I mention, like, saving the environment. Like when I go paperless or when I do certain things.
What do you think should be done? What's something that you feel like is a really an essential next movement or step that should be taken?
I think getting students ownership and investment in it, in like caring for and doing things, making them aware of their own footprint and what they do, because I think a lot of times they don't realize that they themselves have one. I know there's, in the city right now, there's the initiative in Lawrence to ban or get rid of the single-use plastic bags that the city council is debating, which would be good, but it's also an equity issue. You know, if you can't afford the bag, who's going to pay for it? And I think, I don't know, so having leadership think about it as well.
I am the Assistant Director of the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies at the University of Kansas. My name is Aaron Musi. Sustainability for me is being conscious of the systems that contribute to a life and a way of living that will stay, that will last for multiple generations. Sustainability, I think, for me is how we think about and empathize with our past generations and our future generations who are yet to come, and in thinking about what do they need in the past, and it's this goal for us as a species to think, well, what can we do together? So that's what I like about it. One of the really fun initiatives that we've been working on at the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, we actually partner with Karen Lissandra and Amado Espinoza. We're going to be hosting a few different workshops, and we have done a few different workshops in the past. We're going to be having maybe two more workshops this year. The reason I like that project is specifically because it allows the students or whomever we serve with that initiative to connect to the culture, to the indigenous history, to the ancient history, pre-Columbian history, and then bring that into modern times, and then to be thinking about that ancient past history and how that can be recreated using today's products or today's waste products. And so I think from our goal as a center, that really meets several different initiatives for us. And so that's one project that we've been doing and that I'm looking forward to continue with. When we're talking about sustainability, it's a global thing that all of us need to be invested in. And I think what's really great for a school to do is to think about their students as a source of knowledge, as a producer of knowledge, and to figure out ways in which they can ask the student body, what do you know? What do you care about? What do you want to do? I think we are I think we are making our job a lot harder if we don't think about the students as a solution and that they have the power already.
So my name is Pantaleon Flores III. I am a no-till, no-fossil fuel farmer, teaching anyone and everyone who will listen, essentially, trying to reach out to educators, trying to bring people out to the farm or go into spaces like this workshop that we're at today, to reach anybody I can, really. I would obviously take kind of an agricultural approach because that's kind of my side of sustainability. Describing it as really focusing on the practices that we're using, thinking about everything from start to finish, thinking about what inputs we're doing when we do anything at all, thinking about the impact of what we do versus the intent that we have, I think is really important when you're taking any kind of sustainable approach. I would also say resource management is a really important part of that because we are in a system right now that overproduces pretty much everything in every sector you can think of. And if we're thinking of food, we're overproducing by like 40%, I think, is our food waste where we're at right now. So not only when we're thinking about sustainability in the terms of, you know, environmentally, having environmentally safe practices, but also like understanding that when we have the products out of those practices, that there's something that we need to do with those and manage that in a way that isn't being wasteful. So sustainability can mean so many different things to so many different people, but insofar as agriculture, it's really thinking about our inputs and our outputs and managing resources, essentially. Where I got my start in agriculture, I was co-directing a food security nonprofit that was a quarter-acre nursery and a quarter-acre community farm in the middle of Berkeley, South Berkeley. So very population-dense area. It was a site that actually used to be a piece of a railroad. So it was a railway thoroughfare that we repurposed, had the soil tested, made sure there wasn't anything bad there, repurposed into a community center, essentially, an outdoor community center where people could learn about how to grow their own food. They could organize for general food movements. We taught classes there about everything from growing your own food to cleaning up your neighborhoods and building community through food justice. So where I got my start was in South Berkeley on an initiative that was really reaching everyone from the little tiny toddlers that we had running around to like some of the older folks in the community who would come through. I've kind of had this dream for a while that we position our schools, again, this is around food and agriculture, in a way that introduces our youth to how to grow their own food and how to be self-sufficient in a food system. So what I've dreamed of having become a reality is we have elementary schools where they learn how to do the very basic things. They learn about root systems. They learn about germinating seeds, starting seeds, things like that. We have middle schools that are actually functioning nurseries that can then pass off plants to high schools that then take those plants and grow them out as actual food crops for the entire district or school or system of elementary, middle, and high school, who can also then mentor and teach the elementary students and be in a capacity to share the knowledge that they gain throughout their K-12 and return it back to the young folks and also have like a mentor leadership position. So I know that's a very big like system that would be kind of potentially difficult to create, but it also feels like a very natural progression of how to actually learn this stuff and have it really embedded in you as a learner. Find a way to get into food security. I often tell people it's not just about producing. A lot of times people think, oh yeah, if I want to make an impact insofar as like people eating, I have to grow food. Where the reality is that we can all find a piece of the system where we can either be growers, we can be people who distribute the food, we can be people who prepare the food, we can be people who clean up after the people who prepare the food. And so there's really so many different ways to get involved in food security, and it's not just producing.
And finally, the interviews, we're going to hear from Olivia, who got to travel down into Central America and learn more about helping conserve some resources and take care of some endangered species.
So you were in Costa Rica.
Yeah, to study sea turtles.
And did you get to interact directly with turtles then?
Yes.
Hands-on turtle work?
Yeah, we patrolled
the beaches every night for 4 hours, which was exhausting. And, like, looking for turtles that were laying, like, leatherbacks specifically. And we found 3 adults. And we also, we monitored the hatchery. So whenever there were hatchlings that were coming out, we escorted them to the ocean, you could say, making sure no crabs could eat them.
And you were finding a lot of plastic in their environment that was American plastic, I guess.
Yeah. Say,
from the United States.
Yeah, none of it was really in Spanish. It was, almost all of it was in English.
Mm.
With a company called Ecology Project International at Facuare Reserve. An amazing experience.
Yeah.
Because we walked on the beaches and there was bioluminescence. And we could see, like, this giant dinosaur beast coming that was the size of us coming to lay hatchlings. And that was just amazing. I think that the awareness in schooling has laxed. And I think that awareness and inspiring the future generations to, like, ask, why are we doing this, is the best way to change that.
One thing I'm going to tell you today is how we can solve the crisis of the world, which is our climate issue. I will save that answer until the end of my presentation, but just know I do have an answer for it. But where I want to start is this question of what is slow violence, termed by Rob Nixon. It's a very simple concept, but what I want to talk a little bit about are some of the key components of that. We live in an era of rapid and immediate information, as I'm sure you all know. In terms of things, we are on our screen time. This is an interesting statistic for teens. They're on their screens or online for about 9 hours a day. 8 to 12-year-old kids are on their screens for 6 hours. It only grows as we get older. However, there is evidence to suggest that youth are becoming more aware of this and doing what they need to do in order to limit their exposure to this. So there is a positive trend in that sense. But at the same time, I mention this because this is just a very easy way for us to know, as I'm sure all of us have experienced, that we have a lot of information available to us, more so than at any point in the world. And this means that we can gather it faster, we can do it anywhere, and we can do it whenever we like. And what does that mean when we have all this information, when something new can happen every second, or multiple things can happen every second? How does that affect the way in which we perceive our world and the way in which we perceive climate change, the way in which we perceive ecological degradation, which is occurring at an incremental, minute scale that is often imperceptible? And that's exactly what slow violence is about. Can anyone name these disasters? Look familiar to you in any way? Yes?
Is it the Haitian earthquake?
It is not, but close. Okay, Puerto Rico is that one, yeah. Others? It's all from the same time period. Take it as no. Houston, yeah. So we've got Houston up in the corner. We've got Tallahassee, Florida here. The reason I'm pointing these out for you all is because these hurricanes were roughly spread out over a month, just a little bit under that, actually. And I'm going to talk a little bit, and this is a really good example of what we can talk about, what slow violence is exactly. And to do that, I'm going to talk about media coverage of natural disasters in 2017. So from August, when Hurricane Harvey was hitting Houston, there were 104 stories. And this was data captured 3 days before the storm hit and then 3 days after, so about a week of time. And the reason that is looked at is because the 3 days before, those 72 hours, are the prime preparation time, and the 72 hours afterward are the prime rescue and recovery time, right? And so if something is being communicated or something isn't being communicated in that period of time, that's a really big issue for a lot of people. And that's what affects lives. So about 11 hours of total news time was spent towards this. That's not counting print or anything like that. But then we get to September 7th, 14th, and this is Hurricane Irma. We have substantially less, spending of just about 5 hours of coverage. Yes, it wasn't as big of a hurricane. However, it was very strong. Many thousands of people died. A lot of damage, of course. But then we get to Puerto Rico, and just 17 stories ran in that time period. 41 minutes were devoted to that. And it only became a popular issue once it became a political issue, whereas you see Trump throwing, paper towels to the crowd, right? And so this is about in a month's time, and you can see the discrepancy. And this matters for two reasons. First, this means that, as you know, our media today is inundating us with information, and it's hard for anything to be carried on for a long period of time. But then, slow violence is really important to consider because the most vulnerable among us, those who don't have a voice or don't have a platform to share that voice, they are predominantly not focused on by the media. And that becomes an issue when we're talking about ecological degradation, because the people who are going to suffer and who are suffering now are the poorest and weakest among us. And they will be suffering the first and most profoundly in our future. And these are the people who we need to focus on more so, I would argue, than ourselves or the people who are in a position of privilege, people here like us who are able to talk about this and think about it in retrospect. Puerto Rico is still recovering. And so that's exactly what slow violence is. Slow violence is the often imperceptible and yet destructive impact of ecological disaster. What it is not is this volcanic eruption. That is violence that we can understand. It's violence that we can see, understand immediately. We think of violence as something that's happening in that way. This is profoundly violent, but that is not ecological degradation that we commonly see. And what it really is, in order for us to perceive what slow violence is to think big. And that is to think in a geological time scale. That is to think about the history of our world, the history of our universe, to think about how this structure in Arizona can be naturally formed. We will never see this, or we will hardly, maybe never see this change in our lifetimes, but it is formed, and that's what I'm talking about when I talk about slow violence. This is eroded by natural resources, right, and by natural occurrences, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. When we try to perceive slow violence, we need to think bigger. But trash just washed up on the shore in the Philippines, we need to be thinking about that kid there who is in that trash area looking for resources. We need to think about the farmers who are there on the ground who are experiencing degradation, who are experiencing climate change. We need to think about those people who are intimately involved with this, because this is their livelihoods. This is how they derive sustenance. This is how they derive economic power in order to effect change. And the farmers, as you will hear a little bit today, they are the ones who are suffering first and foremost. They are good forecasters to tell us what's happening, but we need to listen to them. We need to think about the most vulnerable among us, the weakest among us. We need to think about the homeless. If we're talking about climate change, if we're talking about heating cities, if we're talking about sea level rising, we're also talking, and what we need to be focusing on, the people who don't have the homes, who don't have houses, who don't have shelters, because they, once again, are going to suffer first and foremost. We need to be thinking about where our trash goes. This is another thing in terms of thinking big and small. This also is from an area in Southeast Asia. We need to be thinking about where our products go in the end and what happens to the places where we send it. And we need to be thinking about the vulnerable populations very much here at home as well. Slow violence is specifically about the fact that we cannot perceive what is happening, and we don't perceive who it's happening to. And what that is what I want you to focus on here today, and hopefully to kind of recenter your focus here today. There, we have a position of privilege, a lot of us do here today, and that position of privilege is not enjoyed by a lot of others. And so when we talk about environmentalism, when we talk about going green, I really want you to center your thoughts on the people that I showed here, and I want you to center your thoughts on your students' thoughts on those populations as well. How can we think bigger than we can imagine? How can we see the unseen? How can we hear the unheard and remember the forgotten? We have to think about those elements as we are confronting this very real element of our current day and age, whereas the next new thing to distract us is just simply a scroll away. And that is where I simply get to stories. As I say, I love stories, I love books. All that I can ever ask you to do, or all that I can ever ask your students to do, is to read a book. And what I would argue, one of the chief ways that we can combat our ecological crisis that we are dealing with in the world is through stories. I know that Diane was talking, and I'm sure you all have heard, we've got 10 to 12 years before we are screwed. And that's absolutely true. It's going to happen, but I would argue, and I'm an eternal optimist, I think we can solve anything. That's really what I do believe. But 10 to 12 years will come, and we will be worse off in that time, and that will happen. And as you noted, and as you were talking about, the high school students, they're going to be graduating from high school then. Nothing's going to happen. That's still the path that they're going to be on. And so then, what do we do, right? I don't want to be all doom and gloom about this, but that is the reality. And so, all that I can ask is that people read. People look at stories. And here's why. Because stories connect us across time and space. I know that's a really cool science fiction type thing to say, but it's very true. We live and we travel to ancient and faraway lands through our stories. We visit the future in all of its splendor and horror. And they make us laugh, and they cry, and they make us cry, and they make us fear, right? Stories, books, these are one of our most powerful tools that we can use in order to combat ecological degradation and our ecological crisis. They make us empathize. That was kind of something that was talked a little bit about here. They make us care. And, you know, we have our new media age is fantastic. We have so many access to documentaries. We can look at so many different images. We can get virtual goggles and we can deep diving through the coral reefs and see how they're dying. Those are hugely immensely important tools for us to show what's happening here. But I would argue that those new media avenues, those new forms of media, are just contributing to the problem that is the fact that we are inundated with more and more information. And what we really need to be doing is focusing on empathy. We need to be focusing on how can we get students to care about this problem, and I would argue that that is happening through stories. I'm supposed to be talking about sustainable practices. I have nothing sustainable for you other than reading. And so what I would encourage you therefore to do, and I brought a couple of examples, but we have many more on our documents, is to read good books. I've got two here that are really fantastic books. This is The Gospel of Trees. This is by Apricot Irving. She is talking a little bit about her family's history in growing trees in Haiti and why that is important. If you know a little bit about the history of Haiti, charcoal is really important for a fuel source there. Deforestation in Haiti is a huge problem there. So this is a really fantastic memoir about what that looks like. And then I have The Farming of Bones by Edwidge Danticat. This is a Haitian author writing about the story of the Haitian Revolution a little bit and how that has evolved over time. And she's talking also about the war between Haiti and the Dominican Republic on the island. And another fantastic, more modern, contemporary book is called The Devil's Highway. The author is Luis Urrea, U-R-R-E-A. And this is a book about the journey, particularly of the Yuma 14, of a group of immigrants who were migrating from Mexico into Arizona, into the New Mexico area. And unfortunately, all but I believe two of these people perished. And it's about what happens to the human body at the border. And it's very gruesome. This book is for high schoolers and above because it's very, very grotesque to know how this natural environment that is not supposed to be lived in, settled in, traversed through, right? This is a desert. This is an inhospitable environment. And yet, we are forcing thousands and thousands of people to go through this area. But more importantly, thousands and thousands of people are choosing to go through this area to get to the other side, to get to where the grass is greener. But the reality is the fact that this is an ecological and environmental crisis that we can look at because it really does center the futility of humans in nature and what we try to do in terms of controlling it. This is an example where nature and its dominion over us is starkly clear. And there are many more books on your educator list. On that flash drive, there are 36 pages of it's a 36-page document. There's a whole bunch of books on there that I would recommend. And what I would encourage you all to do is to read those stories for the nature within them. You can read Huckleberry Finn. You could be reading any number of books. You could be reading Great Expectations for its industrial aspects and to be talking about nature. More importantly, what is important about books is that they connect us to a time, right? And that's the time and space argument that I'm making there. So in that sense, what you want to do as teachers, and we are primed in this position as teachers because kids don't know what to read, and so we can help to recommend what we read, but we can help string together. My grandmother's a librarian, and so I'm of that tradition in the sense that you get this book, and that leads to this book, and that leads to this one, and you keep going, and then you've read the whole library. But the idea is that we need to string those books together so that we can see the geologic time scale that shows us the environmental issues that we are confronting with and why those stories matter. And so that's where I'm asking finally for you to encourage your kids to think big and small. I'm encouraging them to think about the world, to think about our history here, to think about all of the life that has come before and all the life that will come after. It's a big, big curiosity endeavor for them to think about. It will challenge their imagination, and that's what's really fun, but then to recenter them on all the small little instances. All that we really can do is share good stories with one another, encourage us to tell stories about each other, to tell and encourage our students to be the new storytellers. Because without these stories, without the ways in which we connect to the world, we are never going to solve anything. So as I say, 10 to 12 years will pass, and what we will be left with are the books that are recounting our history and telling us of what has happened, and hopefully not this case of why we didn't learn from those books. Hopefully, we in 10 to 12 years, we can recognize those books as our forecast, and they can help us see what is really at stake here, which is all of our history combined.
And that was Aaron Musi from KU's Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies. And if you're interested in finding out more about some great literature selections and learning about different cultures and cultural relevance and sustainability, you can contact me at freelingd@gmail.com. And stay tuned. In just a few minutes, we will be hitting the 7 o'clock hour, and Fiesta Musical will be taking over. So check out a few more messages, and we'll finish up with the calendar and This Week in Water. Thanks for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. This is Dave Bennett Freeling. Tune in next week.
Would you help the annual Global Ties KC program build international relationships by home hosting a student leader in Kansas City? The Global Ties KC program provides a link between international students with proven academic excellence to their area of professional interest. As a host, you'll extend that experience by providing home accommodations Saturday, July 20th through August 1st. For more information, visit globaltieskc.org/homestays.
KKFI is proud to air the 21st Annual Homelessness Marathon on Wednesday from 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. with a half-hour wrap-up by KKFI public affairs people. That's all day Wednesday, right after Democracy Now!
Here's the calendar of events for the week of July 22nd. Tuesday, July 23rd, Wednesday the 24th, or Thursday the 25th, there's a day camp, Beautiful Birds, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Baker Wetlands. At this camp, children 7 to 8 will learn about bird adaptations. There's a fee. Go to bakeru.edu/wetlands. On July 23rd, Green Business Network has a lunch and learn event on local drawdown efforts to reverse the effects of global warming. There's a cost. Registration includes lunch. This will be at Anita B. Gorman Conservation Discovery Center, 4750 Troost Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Register at bridgingthegap.org. Thursday, July 25th, 5 to 7 p.m., Homegrown Happy Hour at the Food Forest, Maston Street and West 55th in Merriam, Kansas, sponsored by Cultivate KC. Also July 25th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Ruiz Library, 2017 West Penway, Kansas City, Missouri. The Missouri Department of Conservation will present about Bats in the Garden, a free workshop. They'll discuss bat behavior, bat houses, bats in Missouri, and how bats can benefit your garden and more. No reservation is necessary. Contact Amy Morris at 816-701-3565. On Friday, 7/26, hike the night, 8:30 p.m. at Baker Wetlands. Email mglade@bakeru.edu. Don't forget your flashlight. Friday, 7/26, Festival of Butterflies begins at Powell Gardens and runs through August 11th. For the opening on 7/26, there will be a Monarch Butterfly Social and Release, 5 to 7 p.m. Go to powellgardens.org. Tickets are required. On Saturday, July 27th, various hours from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Wildlife in Our Big Backyard at Anita B. Gorman Conservation Discovery Center. There's no registration required. All ages are welcome. We'll meet the wild and native trees, flowers, and animals that make a living right here in the middle of Kansas City. Tune in next week when our program is about environmentally safe pest management. These items and more can be found on our Eco Radio KC program page on www.kkfi.org or on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page.
Cigarette butts are a bigger problem than just litter. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
In Atlantic City, New Jersey on July 20th, the mercury hit 99 degrees. While warm temperatures aren't unusual in the summer, what was remarkable was the low. That night it only dropped to 82.
It's a disturbing pattern playing out across the nation. Summer nights are warming up almost twice as fast as daytime temperatures.
The New York Times reports that the combination of hot days and then hot nights can have lethal effects because the body doesn't have a chance to cool down.
The U.S. Global Change Research Program says that since the 1960s, the average number of heat waves has tripled in 50 American cities.
We now get an average of 6 heat waves a year, which are staying in place longer, and the threat of more of them increases with climate change.
Michael Mann of Penn State said that the planet has already warmed 1 degree Celsius, which can cause a tenfold increase in the frequency of 100 degree days in places like New York City.
Millions flock to see Joshua trees in Southern California each year in their namesake national park. But if you want to see the famous yuccas, you better hurry. They may not be around in a few decades.
Researchers at UC Riverside predict that nearly all of them will become extinct if nothing is done to stem carbon emissions. In the best-case scenario, only 20% of the trees may survive in the next 50 years.
In a release from the university, the scientists say that in hotter, drier areas, adult trees aren't producing as many young plants, and even the ones they do produce aren't surviving. Now, some of the Joshua trees are migrating to higher elevations where there's more moisture.
Joshua trees as a species have existed since the Pleistocene era, about 2.5 million years ago, and individual trees can live up to 300 years.
One of the ways adult trees survive so long is by storing large reserves of water to cope during droughts. But younger trees and seedlings aren't capable of holding moisture this way.
A study also found that in cooler, wetter parts of the park, the biggest threat other than climate change is fire.
Fewer than 10% of Joshua trees survive wildfires, which have been exacerbated in recent years by car and industrial exhaust. The smog deposits nitrogen on the ground, which in turn feeds non-native grasses that act as kindling.
Cigarette butts are the most common form of litter on Earth, and now a new study shows that they significantly damage plants.
Scientists found that their presence in soils reduced plant germination and the size of roots and stems.
Even cigarettes that had not been smoked affected plants, allowing researchers to conclude that damage is caused by the filter itself, most of which is made from a type of bioplastic.
In a release from Anglia Ruskin University in the UK, one of the researchers said that the chemicals in the filters may be leaching out and affecting the early stages of plant development.
It's estimated that about 4.5 trillion cigarette butts are littered every year. The scientists added that many smokers think tossed cigarettes biodegrade, when in reality it can take years, if not decades, for them to break down.
The ice melt occurring in Antarctica is the fastest ever in history and a major driver of global sea level rise.
The National Science Foundation reports that in the last 6 years, 5 closely observed Antarctic glaciers have doubled their rate of ice loss. At least one